when there's a child and that child's life is being taken, there's nothing else can argue against that. Like, I think the kite, in my opinion, represents that. It represents innocence, it represents life. And I think it connects us as humans for some reason. I think it connects that part of us, like that playful side of us that thinks of, you know, making a memory with a family member, a child's laughter, it just brings it down to the most simple form of why we're here on this planet.
Hello, and welcome back to the Art Persist podcast, a series by Bosler Art, offering a glimpse into the life of artists and activists from all over the world, here to share their stories with you, the listener. My name's Georgia, and in this episode, Bosler Art's own Hossam Fazula interviews Melissa Bolivar from Kites in Solidarity. Kites in Solidarity is a grassroots movement of volunteers which was founded in 2023 in response to the ongoing siege of Gaza. The movement was inspired by the 2011 world record for the most kites flown simultaneously, which was achieved by the children of the Gaza Strip. Hossam and Melissa talk about her decision to start Kites in Solidarity, how looking on her phone every day and seeing the horrors come out of Gaza really drove her to start this global movement. And she shares her advice of how other people who want to do something but don't know how can also make changes they want to see in the world.
So your name is Melissa Bolivar.
Yes, that's correct.
Really cool. You should be like a famous actress.
Thank you. Do you know about the Bolivar history at all, by any chance?
Tell me.
So I'm not related because he had no children, but Simon Bolivar actually liberated the South Americas, Colombia, Ecuador and Bolivia from the Spanish, funnily enough. Yeah. So.
And how are you related to this?
I have no idea, but it's my surname and I am Colombian. So I like to, he inspires me, I guess. But yeah, apart from that, there's no blood relation, unfortunately.
I see. I think this is the perfect introduction to today's episode, actually. Let's keep it. All right. So I want to say, Melissa Bolivar.
Yes.
How are you? How are you feeling today?
I feel good. A little bit nervous, but yeah, I feel great. I'm happy to be here. Very honored to be here.
Melissa, welcome to the Art Persist podcast. We're very excited to have you especially speak about Kites in Solidarity. Well, first of all, why don't you tell us about your early life? Where did you grow up and what was life like?
So first of all, thanks so much for having me. It's an absolute honor to be here, especially to talk about Kites in Solidarity. And yeah, a bit about me. I grew up in Camden Town, not too far from here, from Haggerston. And my parents came to London in the 80s as immigrants. And I essentially just grew up in Camden. My parents were working class and my life was very eclectic, I would say, in the sense that, you know, I would kind of go to my school in Camden, in Archway, where my classroom was super diverse, full of, I had like loads of different girls from different ethnicities, like Nigeria, Jamaica, Turkey. Mm-hmm. And then I'd kind of go home and then just speak to my mom in Spanish and she would give me the pot of frijoles, which is like a very Colombian meal. And then on the weekends, I would go to Brixton and go to like a Colombian house party, dancing reggaeton with my Latino friends. And then maybe on the following weekend, I'd go to Highbury and Islington and I'd be dancing Tony Matter and the Dirty Wine with all of my, you know, like Jamaican friends. So I feel like I've been very lucky to grow up in this like super, you know, culturally diverse city where I've just experienced so many different experiences and cultures and learned so much from so many different people. So yeah,
that's kind of... I myself, like I came to London 6 years ago.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And it really, like, it just really feels like home more than anything. And I think it's just because it is, like, how diverse it is. And yeah, I really found myself here.
Wow. That's very interesting.
Let's keep it this way.
Yeah. No, that's really interesting, actually.
Yeah, especially with what's happening now, like the far right riots and,
for sure,
and all of this ugliness. So besides from Kites and Solidarity, and you know, we're gonna speak about this in a bit, but you are a very creative person, you're a designer, and again, from like your early life, I wanted to ask you, have you always been creative? When did you went into the kind of creative side of things, or how did that come about?
Just I've always been creative from like as early as I can remember, actually. Art was always my favorite subject, that type of thing. So yeah, it's always been a really big part of my life, and encouraged from my like mom. So yeah.
So the family is artistic as well, or?
No, well, my mom now, actually, she's taken up kind of art classes in her later like years. But what I mean to say is she always like would encourage me to practice my art, or like, you know, sometimes I'd get an art tutor every now and then. So like I just always got encouraged to do art, which was really nice to have that support, because I know some families or some people don't get the same type of support with the arts for some reason. I don't know why, but I think with immigrant parents as well, they kind of want you to like do really well, so they're like, you know, go become a doctor or whatever. So but I think with my mom, very luckily, I was very supported in that way.
So what did you used to do when you were young?
What, sorry?
How did your creativity manifest?
How did it manifest? Okay.
Like, what is it? Oh, were you like drawing, or?
Do you know what? It's really interesting. There's actually one particular thing that I really remember from being creative when I was younger. It was like this task we had to do in year four, and it was to design a suite. And I remember that I was like really excited, and we had like a little team of four people, and I was like, right, we're going to design a sour apple sweet. And I think no one actually really liked the idea, but I was really keen on it. It was just like, right, guys, I designed like the little apple and like the packaging. And I think that was my first experience. So I was like, I love design. I love making something and like creating it. Yeah, that was my first experience.
That's a great story. And how was the sweet in the end?
We never actually got to make the suite. We just got to design it. But like, I think that was my first like design experience, like product design experience. Yeah,
oh, that's very nice. Yeah. So from designing apple sour sweets to designing a global movement like Guys in Solidarity, can you introduce Guys in Solidarity to us?
Okay, that's quite a big task, but I'll do my best.
Yeah.
So Kites in Solidarity is a global kite flying movement that honors the children of Gaza that broke the world record in 2011 for the most kites flown at Awaha Beach. It was 12,351 kites, and they broke the Guinness World Record against China, which I find fascinating.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Because obviously Gaza Strip is like one-fifth the size of London, and then you have like this global, you know,
power of China.
And you know, little Gaza wins. Like, I love that kind of, yeah.
And obviously Gaza was in a siege for many years before.
Exactly. Limited resources, but still they managed to achieve something like that. I find absolutely fascinating.
So it's a global movement. How does this like happen?
So Kites in Solidarity is a grassroots movement run essentially from London by a group of female volunteers, and we essentially do these global call outs inviting people all around the world to fly their kites in solidarity with Gaza. We've been doing them since November, and since then we've essentially had 6 kite flights. I think 5 of them or 4 of them have been global. And we've had over 200 locations in 30 countries, probably over like 50 cities around the world. And we predict maybe over 10,000 people have taken part in the flights.
I believe that.
Yeah.
So it's just one day, people from all over the world flying kites at the same time.
Correct.
It's fascinating. And what is it that inspired you to start it?
So
I know that some, like, obviously in 2023 there was you had this inspiration, and then also I have a an insight that that even 3 years before you had something happened that inspired you to do it.
Yes, correct. So,
but I don't know what it is.
This is really fascinating, actually, because I feel like a big part of Kites and Solidarity is social media and the power of social media. And I think that a big part of the Palestine movement in general has been social media driven. And because of, you know, obviously our how we use our phones, how we use Instagram, it completely has changed how we've responded to this. For example, in comparison to, like, you know,
the Iraq war.
Yeah. Exactly.
Because we didn't have social media.
We didn't have social media, so we would just turn on BBC News and we'd be like, yep, yeah, great, that's happening.
Exactly.
Yeah. But obviously that's completely, like, completely changed now. Yeah. So about 3 years ago, I was actually on my phone, and I don't know how I started following, like, people in Gaza. I just, one of those random things. Mm. I think I started to follow MC Abdul, who's this rapper. He's like...
They're a very young rapper.
And I was watching him when he was like nine rapping in Gaza. I just got really into it. And then somehow I ended up on someone's Instagram, on an Instagram live. And the live was actually happening at Al-Aqsa Mosque. Am I saying it correctly? Al-Aqsa Mosque. And there was just like these girls, and they were kind of walking together, and suddenly they just, people just started shooting at them. And everyone was screaming. Obviously, the next day in the newspapers, because I read about it online, I think, I don't know if it was BBC or one of the British newspapers, they were talking about how the people at Al-Aqsa were being disruptive. And obviously I'd been watching the live, so I was like, well, it didn't seem like that. That was kind of my first kind of moment where I was witnessing something from, I guess, someone in Gaza's perspective, and then also viewing it from the British media perspective, and I could just see that it wasn't aligning. And then shortly after that, I was still following, like, these people in Gaza, and I remember seeing it was in Sheikh Jarrah, the neighbourhood, which I believe is now, I don't know if it's now completely like taken over, I'm not sure, but
I think it might be.
But at the time, I think they were still trying to hold on to it, and there was a family and they were having a party on the street, and I remember they had Palestinian balloons, so they had like balloons, like red balloons, green balloons, white balloons, black balloons, and the balloons were just hanging above the table in the middle of the street. And I remember just on an Instagram live seeing this an IDF person on a horse just go up to the party and take the balloons and just destroy them. I remember just thinking, I can't imagine in the UK a police officer going to someone's street party and like breaking the balloons. And I think in that moment, I just understood that it was this attempt to completely just oppress someone and oppress even the moment of a family sharing a dinner.
Yeah.
In the comfort of their own street, or, and even the concept of a balloon being such a playful and happy thing, that this soldier had to come and destroy it. It was like, you can't even give them this playful thing or something that represents their nationality or heritage. I think from that moment, I knew that it was just something that it didn't sit well with me. And that happened 3 years ago. But basically from there, I just started doing a lot of research into Palestine, obviously found out about the siege and the blockade. And I found many articles from the United Nations, which were reports declaring that Palestine territory was apartheid. And, you know, even the United Nations described it as an open air prison, because it had inadequate access to power, water and health. And people didn't have the ability to freely leave the Gaza Strip or whether to go to the rest of Palestine or to the outside world. So I think essentially it was very clear from the reports and the evidence that there was something
Completely wrong.
Completely wrong. And the world wasn't doing anything about it, basically.
Yeah, not at all. Mm.
But at the time, I remember trying to share stuff on Instagram because I'm a bit of a sharer. So I was just like trying to share things and it was like falling on deaf ears. No one cared. This was like 3 years ago. Mm. So I kind of eventually just gave up a little bit, if I'm honest. And I was just like, okay, well, this is just what it is. This is just happening. Yeah. But from that day, from like 2 or 3 years ago when this happened, I remember just seeing consistent, oh, the so-and-so child's been killed, so-and-so person's been arrested without trial, you know, this neighbourhood's been taking over, this family's home's being demolished. So it was consistent news, but no one, you know, no one's
doing anything.
No one cared, no one, it wasn't like news or anything at the time. But so I was kind of viewing all of this stuff for like 3 years before what happened, before Kites and Solidarity and before October last year, 2023. Yeah.
So what is it that made you feel like, oh, now is the time to actually do something?
So obviously what happened was horrific. And I think that at the time, I remember just thinking, because of what I had witnessed for the last 3 years, I had a feeling that this was what was going to be used as an excuse to completely colonize Palestine.
You mean the 7th of October?
Yeah.
Yeah. Remember when I woke up and I saw Netanyahu's speech, I was like, and what happened? I was like, oh my God, the next year is going to be dark.
Yes. Mm. Yeah. I instantly, if I'm honest, I felt like that was going to be their reason and their excuse.
To just demolish.
To demolish it and colonize it completely.
Which is kind of what's happening.
Yeah. And because of obviously the things that I had seen and the research that I had done, I just thought, well, okay, if this is actually going to happen, if this is what's going to happen, a lot of people are going to die. A lot of people are going to get hurt. A lot of families are going to be destroyed. I really like instantly thought, oh my God, this is going to be really, really bad. Yeah. And at the time, I remember thinking and seeing what was happening in the media and how they were describing Palestinian people and how they were dehumanizing Palestinian people. And I remember just at the time, even sharing a post on social media was so controversial that people were losing their jobs.
The whole of October was told that maybe the bombing of the hospital, and still,
people.
It wasn't like now.
No, I remember I remember watching TV and people saying, oh, you can't show the Palestinian flag because it's wrong. And I remember thinking, no, it's the flag of their country. Like, this is completely wrong. But all of the information that the media was sharing was so one-sided. Yeah. And I understand, obviously, why. But I felt that in that process, we were almost being prepared to accept the what would come, which was going to be the destruction of Gaza.
Yeah.
So in completely portraying a people as a one thing and dehumanizing them, what's to come after that is, you know, when they are being, you know, obliterated as they have been, no one's going to say anything because it's been justified. And I think that regardless of what happened on that day, there are innocent people, there are human beings, there are mums, dads, daughters, sons, brothers, sisters, just like all of us that are there. And for me, that's I think what kicked me into action. And I have to use my voice to share to people that actually this isn't, you know, what the media is necessarily saying or how they're portraying Palestinian people to be.
Wow, this is amazing. That's a great answer. So it was just like to humanize Palestinians when they were very much dehumanized in October.
Correct. I felt that at the time. Obviously, I have a very, you know, mixed group of friends, and I can just see that even within my own like circles, that there was just no understanding of what had happened, what was happening in Palestine previously, of the history. And also because of what the media was sharing and telling us about what, you know, who Palestinians were, essentially, people didn't feel like they could even speak up or share a post saying, actually, you know, a hospital shouldn't be bombed, or, you know, children shouldn't be killed, because they couldn't, literally could not, they was literally enabled to speak.
I remember that period very much.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I remember just being like, you know, this is actually, this is people's voices being silenced. Essentially, people were scared to speak up. So I, in my mind, I was comparing that to previous, you know, historical events where that's happened. I don't want to say specifics, but when people can feel afraid to speak up, like, I feel like, you know, we're not in the time. Luckily, we don't live in Gaza, or, you know, I'm Colombian. In Colombia, there have been periods where people speak up and they get killed, you know. Mm. I live in the UK. I can speak up. Like, I can use my voice and not be murdered. So why would I not use my voice to say what's right? Even if people might, you know, have an opinion of me at the time, because of the history and because I understood what had previously happened, I was brave enough to just be like, actually, eventually the truth will come to light. Mm. I just had a belief. I was like, no. Even if right now I look crazy, I know that in 6 months or 9 months or 1 year or 2 years, or in my head, actually, to be honest with you, I was ready for 50 years. Mm. I was like, I'm ready to be wrong for 100 years. And then in 100 years, if it all comes out that this was a genocide, then people are going to look back and be like, oh, she wasn't crazy. I was literally ready to be crazy for, I'm not even joking. I was like, that's fine. That's fine with me. But I'm going to say something.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's actually like, I agree. I didn't expect that the sort of like majority is gonna be, oh, this is genocide, this is fucked up, as soon as they did, actually.
100%.
Yeah. I really expected it to go for even longer.
100%.
Yeah. It's good that now the majority are pro-Palestine, are seeing what is happening as a catastrophe. And well, it's not a silver lining, because there's no silver lining to what's happening, but it's good at least that a lot of people are now aware of what is happening there and what has been happening for many years.
But you're right. But I think the difference between past historical events where it has taken 50 years or how many years for people to recognize a genocide because of our phones, this time I think the turnaround was a lot quicker. Mm-hmm. That's why I think it was 6 months.
Yeah, yeah.
And not 20 years.
And actually, I didn't know that, but apparently one of the biggest, obviously in London, there was 1 million people that demonstrated at one point for Palestine. But apparently last time this happened was during Iraq War. So there were 1 million people that went demonstrating.
During what, sorry?
During the Iraq War.
Oh, yeah.
Here in London, a million people. So, yeah, it's sometimes the word maybe is not as bad as we imagine it to
You're
be.
You're right. Actually, yeah, I think you're right.
We obviously worked together on the last Guides in Solidarity. It was during Refugee Week.
Yeah.
And I was asked, like, what was the highlight of this Refugee Week for you? And so Refugee Week is a week during World Refugee Day. It's a whole week of a massive festival, the biggest festival in the world celebrating refugees. And there were so many highlights for me. But I said that my highlight was working on Kites and Solidarity, because just like, I don't know, just opening my Instagram, seeing that as we are holding that event in London and flying our kites, we made our kite, Georgia made a beautiful kite as well. But as we were flying these kites, I saw Bisan posting, hundreds of kids around her flying kites in Gaza. And people were flying kites in the US and in many other places. And it's just like, that was very, very powerful. And my question to you is that, why is it powerful? Why is something as simple as flying a kite, but also obviously very creative, is powerful?
I think the kite pairs back everything to the most simplest form, which is love. When we look at everything that's going on, it's so complicated. It's this, it's that. There's so many people want to embellish it and all these things. But ultimately, when there's a child and that child's life is being taken, there's nothing else can argue against that. Like, I think the kite, in my opinion, represents that. It represents innocence. It represents life. And I think it connects us as humans for some reason. I think it connects that part of us, like that playful side of us, that side of us that thinks of, you know, making a memory with a family member, you know, like a child's laughter, it just brings it down to the most simple form of why we're here on this planet, which is to love each other, to, yeah. So I think that, in my opinion, is why it's so powerful, because it just destroys every single preconception, every single word or thing that the media wants to say or that people want to believe. It just goes like, no. Like, where's your heart? That's what I think it does, in my opinion. Oh yeah, it makes your heart just go. That's so cute.
Hi, this is Hossam Fazula, co-founder of Bosla Arts. The Artpists podcast is independently run by Bosla Arts, me and Georgia, which allows us to share these important conversations with artists and activists from all over the world. In order to keep having these conversations, we need your help. Join us on Patreon for as little as £3 and help us continue this vital work. More info in the episode description. Now back to the podcast.
It might be a cliche, but it's an important question. What's your message to the kids in Gaza?
Oh my God, yeah. Wow, that's a big question.
Through Christ and solidarity, what is it that you're saying to them?
I think we are saying, we love you. We love you. Like, that is literally what we're saying. That's it. Yeah.
I guess that's very powerful. You don't need to say anything else. Do you have any stories to share since you started Christ and Solidarity? Moments that really stuck with you, moments that made you feel...
I think the first kite flight that we did in Hampstead Heath, we did it 2 weeks. Initially, basically, I posted a little poster for people to come to the protest, and like 12 people arrived. Five of them were my friends. The others were just... people from Instagram online. It was amazing. I couldn't believe anyone even showed up. But I met this amazing artist called Emily Rand, who basically helped us with all of our posters and created a lot of the graphics. And she was really, really incredible. But
she's the one that designed the kites.
She basically would do all of our like posters.
Yeah, the kites on the illustration. Yeah.
Actually, no, that's another artist Angela Kirkwood.
Okay, I have a
but
question.
But we've kind of worked with loads of different artists. But she basically came on board with another girl called Lisa as well, Lisa Rahman. She also does graphics. And we essentially created the first kind of Cut in Solidarity event, which happened in Hampstead. And we just obviously go to Hampstead having no clue what was going to happen. And about 1,000 people showed up, all different, you know, ethnicities and ages. And I promise you, I've never, like, the feeling on that hill in Hampstead was so unbelievable. I can genuinely describe it. It was like being in heaven, because it was like golden, like, light. There was like, obviously, Hampstead, and there was just children like laughing, running around, like with the kites in the air. There were people crying, genuinely crying, because people had not had the opportunity. Some of them, they didn't feel safe enough to go to a protest. They didn't want to go to a protest. They'd come here. And they were just like literally in tears, just saying like, I can't believe what's been happening. I'm so devastated. You know, I'm really happy that I can be here with this community right now and grieve or express, or, oh my God, you understand that, you know, seeing a child in the way that we've seen it online, like, it's horrific, and we're hurting. This is awful. So being in that moment, in that place where it just came to life. And I remember we had like a playlist which had like the Black Eyed Peas playing. It was like, Where Is the Love? And like these amazing like inspirational music playing, and it was just absolutely beautiful. Like, I can't even, for me it's like goosebumps like that. And for the girls that, you know, made this happen, us just being there together and like looking around like, oh my God, fuck, we did this. Like, this is crazy. That was unbelievable. And then from there, it was like, we just didn't know when it was going to stop, but it just got bigger and bigger. And every, you know, week we'd have people in all parts of the world, like Texas, Memphis, Miami, South Africa, like the list goes on. Yeah, like, God, there's literally all over the world, and Mexico. Yeah, it was unbelievable. And seeing also like the kites in different locations, in snow, in like palm trees, seeing all of people just all around the world just like doing something amazing that just connected everyone. And they were like, yeah, like, we are with Gaza, we are like, we all feel the same way. Like, it was just unbelievable. I can't even put it into words. So I can.
I can believe that. It's incredible how global Kaizen solidarity is. And when we worked together, I was just doing small stuff, but the team was organizing this massive thing, and every day I would see the poster of where it's happening getting more and more in different countries. And I just all of that, like, I think you're working on a group on WhatsApp, just all texting each other. Yeah. You're all volunteers, nobody's getting paid, you're all obviously doing that in your free time. How do you even go about doing something like this with this much impact and global like this while it's just a group of volunteers? And I just want to know more about, like, how did this happen?
Every single person I've met on this journey that is part of this movement has a job, like, that is another job, has children, has family. And I really have seen these women and people just sacrifice so much to make these events happen and to make this happen. It literally, people just going, like, having Zoom calls at 7 p.m. at night or working on their weekends to do workshops. And people do it because they are genuinely so concerned about what's happening and they're so desperate to get this message out and to make people react or to make people feel something that they literally are sacrificing so much. You know, it is a collective effort. In our volunteer team, for example, we had like people doing admin, checking emails, registering people. We had that was amazing woman, Kate and Orla, who work in like admin. And then, you know, Lisa, who did all the graphics. We had Emily doing artwork. Angela Kirkwood as well did artwork for us. So it is just like a big team of women, essentially, who are just chipping away and just making this little team. And what we would do is essentially send a global call out, just asking whoever wants to take part to register. And we would just get people all around the world registering, basically, and writing to us being like, I want to take part and I'm in Miami and I've got a group of five people, or I'm in Cape Town and I have a group of 500 people, or I'm in, you know, oh God, there was one in, I think it was Stockholm, and they had a snow one with skiers. And I think they had like 500 people there. I mean, it's insane how many people would get...
Flying kites while skiing?
Yes, flying kites while skiing.
As if skiing enough is not hard.
Yeah, they were flying kites while skiing. Oh my God. I know. And people were just doing these... I don't even know how they would get this amount of people together, but I genuinely believe that it is because of the Palestine movement in general that has inspired people, and people are just willing to just get involved and do something.
Mm.
Yeah.
Do you have a message? Like, for example, there's so many people that feel like they want to do something about what's happening, or they want to do something in general when it comes to, global solidarity, but they don't know what it is. Do you have like any tips?
I think my first tip
for the future generations.
For the future generation. I think my first tip is think about the world you live in and what you want to improve about it. I think the second tip, I've got three.
Okay.
The second tip, I think, is I know it sounds cheesy, but I really think it helped me, like, lead with love, because I think ultimately that's the number one thing that moves everyone. And whether that's climate change, whether that is whatever you're trying to do, I think that if you lead with love, then you're going to connect with people and you're going to be able to, you know, explain why you're doing something like that, because people are only going to do something if they feel connected to it. And the third I would say is be a rebel. And because I think if you're too afraid to offend someone, or you're never going to get anything done. And I think you have to just kind of just be like, I'm just going to do this anyway, don't really care what anyone thinks. And also, and number four, so one more, is I think it's really important to take, in a weird way, you have to take away the importance from everything you do. I think if in any moment I'd thought, oh, this is that, this is a global movement, or only kind of this kind of person can achieve that, I think I would have never done it. I had to almost, in my head, just break it down. Like, I'm just going to make a poster. We're just going to make a poster and that's it. We're just going to invite people along and just break it down to the base of what it is you're doing, and don't try to overthink it into this big thing, basically. That's how I just have, yeah. Otherwise, you're just going to go crazy thinking about it, basically.
Well, Melissa, it's been a pleasure to get to know you and work with you and finally have this chat. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Paz.
We'd like to thank Melissa Bolivar for joining us for this week's episode. If you'd like to learn more about Kites in Solidarity or even get involved, you can find links in the episode description. And thank you for listening to another episode of the Artpersist podcast. As always, if you are enjoying the podcast, please follow us, share and rate it. Only with your help can these really important stories be heard. Thanks for listening, and we'll be back next week with another episode.